T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Good morning and welcome to the Morning Briefing for Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer, and we have a great show lined up for you today. On today's show, we'll speak to HillVets founder Justin Brown. HillVets works to ensure that veterans' voices are heard on Capitol Hill and to make sure us vets know what's going on Capitol Hill that will affect us as well. Later, the events manager at Grunt Style, Justin Orrick, will tell us how he went from the Marine Corps team to Team Grunt Style. And he'll have all the details on their upcoming Grunt Fest 6, which is taking place out in Chicago in just about a week and a half. So a busy Tuesday. And it all starts now as we replay an interview that we did with a Hollywood superstar, a military legend in the world of acting, Captain Dale Dye. Our next guest is a combat veteran, a Marine Corps veteran, and a very impressive man overall. And he's someone who's become kind of a face of the military, because even if you don't recognize his name, if I name some of the film and TV projects he's been involved in, you will recognize those. And if you think about it, you'll probably know who he was in them. I'm talking about movies like Platoon, Saving Private Ryan, TV shows like Band of Brothers, and that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Dale Dye, Captain Dale Dye of the United States Marine Corps, to be precise. And he has gotten up early out there in California to join us on the Morning Briefing. Captain, how are you doing this morning?
I'm fine, Eric. Thanks very much for giving me the shot. Early reveille doesn't bother Marines. We're in good shape.
There you go. In the Navy and Marine Corps family, you and I both know getting up early, that's not a problem. That's just what you got to do some days. So when we talk about the fact...
Yeah, thrice up and give the ship a cleanest sweep down.
There you go. Sweep down all decks, ladders, ladder backs, and passageways. Captain Dye, of course, you served, as I mentioned, in the Marine Corps in Vietnam. So tell us just a little bit about your service. Where did you join out of? Where are you originally from? And what did you do in the Corps?
Well, I'm originally from Southeast Missouri. You can probably tell by the way I pronounce the name of that state that I'm a little south of the area. But I enlisted in January of 1964 out of St. Louis, Missouri, and went to boot camp, trained as an infantryman originally, and then changed my MOS, became what the Marine Corps calls a combat correspondent, primarily based on the fact that I had graduated from military schools and edited a high school newspaper and that sort of thing. And I wanted to be in a position where I could see more than just the back of the other guy's pack. And being a combat correspondent allowed me to do that. It allowed me to do anything that I really wanted to in the Marine Corps, as long as I could produce a little story and a little picture about it. In 1967, they sent me to Vietnam, the 1st Marine Division, and I found out why the Marine Corps calls it combat correspondent, with the emphasis on the first word. We were essentially glorified riflemen who went along with the battalions and ran to the sound of the guns and observed what went on and took part whenever we could. So I did that. I survived quite a number of major combat operations. I fought in Hue in Tet of 1968. I was wounded a couple of times. I survived multiple tours and came home and decided that I would stay with the Marine Corps. I really appreciated what I had seen in combat, and I appreciated the little guy with a rusty rifle in the rear rank who really makes up the heart and soul of our American military. And I came to a great appreciation of that. I decided I wanted to stay around it, so I reenlisted. Stayed for about 13 years as an enlisted man, rose to be a senior NCO, then was chosen to become an officer, became a warrant officer, converted my commission from warrant directly to first lieutenant, and was a captain by the time I got my second shot at getting shot at, and that was in Beirut, Lebanon, in 82-83. Finally retired in 1984, and that's way too much information, Eric, but there you have it.
Well, a long and, as you said, decorated career. The Bronze Star with V among your awards, multiple Purple Hearts earned over in Vietnam. Now, you leave the military in 1984. It's been a part of your life for 20-plus years. What was that transition period for you like? I mean, a lot of people think of Marines as fearless, but did you have any fear and trepidation as you went to move from being on active duty to being a veteran?
I have fear and trepidation with every breath I take, but the truth of the matter is, in those days, Eric, we didn't have a lot of the transition training and sort of babysitting that and I don't mean that in a derogatory fashion, but the concern that for transitioning Marine sailors, airmen, soldiers, Coast Guardsmen, that there is today. It was kind of, thank you for your service. There's the door. Don't let it hit you in the butt on the way out. And good luck. Here's how you apply for the GI Bill. There wasn't a lot of that concern. So you kind of stood out there naked and afraid and wondered, you know, what the hell am I going to do here? And in my case, that was essentially true. I mean, I got to thinking, you know, what can I really bring to the table here? You know, I'd been shot too many times to want to be a cop on America's mean streets, and I knew that, you know, if I got into defense contracting or ended up in some corporate cubicle, that, you know, I'd be a suicide in about 6 months. So I needed to do something, and I got to doing a bunch of introspection, and I said, you know, what's the common denominator here? What do I have? And I found out that I was always a movie buff all my life, Eric. I mean, I guess it's natural, but I had seen every military movie there was, I thought. And the common denominator there was that the majority of them upset me. I mean, they just didn't represent who we were, who I knew we were, right, from my own personal experience. And every veteran knows that. I mean, you go see a military movie, and the first thing you see is some stupid error, some stupid activity that would never happen. And you say, ah, crap. And you walk out. And I'd had that experience so many times. And I got to researching it, and I looked around, and I would see a credit at the end of a film, and it would say technical advisor, and it would be, you know, Major Umpty Frats, United States Army retired. And I said, well, how the hell can they make all these mistakes?
Right.
I don't get it. So, you know, when you're ignorant, you can do a lot of things that people tell you can't do. With that in mind, I came out to L.A. and began to research this. And the light began to glow. I found out that there was a great deal of hubris. And I use that term advisedly in Hollywood, especially among auteur filmmakers who sincerely felt that anybody who spent any time in uniform could not conceivably have a creative bone in his or her body.
Right.
Because if they did, why the hell would they go and be a soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine? And that attitude really was prevalent. And so they would hire somebody just for the sake of finding out which side the ribbons go on. and that would be the extent of it. I began to realize, okay, here's what's wrong. These folks have no idea who we really are, how we really talk, how we really walk, how we relate to each other. What the concept of relying on the guy to your right and your left to survive in combat is about. And so it's natural that they miss it. when they're doing these films, so that they dream up some fantastic circumstance and put the poor military in it. And that upset me. I said, well, you know, this is easy to fix. I'm an old Marine. I know how to train people. I can do this. Just give me your actors. I'll show them the truth. I'll demonstrate it for them and make them live in it, and they'll get it. Because they're actors. I mean, they're dry sponges. They understand about emotions. They understand about psychology, things like that. So that was my premise. Give me your actors and let me unscrew this mess. And then whatever they do for you on screen is going to be the right stuff.
Right.
I wanted to go deeper than just the superficial business. Look, you can teach a chimpanzee how to carry a rifle and wear the right equipment, and you can make corrections like, you know, not carrying M16 rifles in a World War II picture. You can do that sort of thing, and frankly, that's what most technical advisors had done before I came on the scene, because that's all they were allowed to do. That's as close to the project as they were allowed to get. That wasn't my way of doing things. It wasn't the military way of doing things, and I knew better because I'd trained men all of my life, so I knew what could be done. But selling that to Hollywood was a difficult proposition, my friend.
Yeah.
I ran up against every brick wall you could find. They would look at me and they'd say, look, we've made military movies for decades, and we've made zillions of dollars. Mm. Why do we need you and your stupid, you know, Stanislavski full immersion methods? Why do we need that?
Right.
You know, why should we spend money on that? So here's the door, and don't let it pinch you on the way out. So it was really very difficult. I kept at it, but I was about to give up because Hollywood is such a closed shop. So hard a nut to crack. And then I had learned to read the trade papers, Daily Variety and Hollywood Reporter and papers like that that cover showbiz. And I saw this little announcement in one of those papers that said a heretofore relatively unknown writer-director by the name of Oliver Stone was going to do a movie based on his own experience as a combat infantryman in Vietnam. And I knew at that moment that this guy, whoever the hell he was, this guy would really understand why I wanted to do things differently. And through a series of machinations that I really can't tell you about because the statute of limitations probably hasn't run out, I was able to get a hold of Oliver Stone, and I did my best 2-minute pitch, and I ran it down for him why I thought so many war movies were screwed up and how we could fix them. And he got it right away. He said, "Oh yeah, you know that's right. That's what we need. These guys need to understand who we were and what we were when we were 19 in those jungles." And I said, "Right." So he trusted me. We were great political, we're at opposite ends of the political spectrum, but that didn't mean anything because we were both common combat veterans.
Right.
And we knew what the deal was. So he gave me 33 actors and 3 weeks. And these were actors who, in those days, the name didn't mean anything, but they certainly do today. Forrest Whitaker, Johnny Depp, Charlie Sheen, Tom Berenger, Willem Dafoe, and I took them into the mountains of the Philippines, into the Philippine jungles, and for 3 weeks they were totally isolated and they lived as combat soldiers did in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. And I mean, that was all there was. They dug a hole and they lived in it. They slept in it. And I trained them every day. They got about 2 hours sleep a day. They got, you know, they only ate twice a day or once if they pissed me off. And essentially, when I brought them down out of those mountains, they were who Oliver Stone and I were when we were 19 and 20 in Vietnam. And so we put that little film together, a little $5 million film, and brought it home. I was there with Oliver coaching and getting the best performance, the correct performance out of the actors all the way through. We brought that little film home. It was titled Platoon. And we immediately blew everything off the stage. We won 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director for Oliver Stone. And he was very kind to recognize my contributions to the film during the Academy Awards. And so at that point, all of my theories, which had seemed so wild to Hollywood before that, now became de rigueur. Everybody wanted me to work on their films. And that was the beginning of Warriors Incorporated, which is my company. We went on to do many terrific films. I think about 50, 51 of them so far to date. I got to work with some really great directors, Roberto Benigni, Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks, and on and on and on. Bob Zemeckis, and they really taught me filmmaking. They taught me the technical aspects of it, and thank God they did. I expanded the company because military films only get made every once in a while. They aren't churned out every two or three every year. So my company, in order to stay in business and keep some people gainfully employed, I sort of expanded our repertoire, and we got into themed entertainment for theme parks that had rides and that sort of thing that had a military aspect. For instance, we did Star Trek: The Adventure for Hilton Hotels in Hollywood, in which we went and trained all of their performers how to be Starfleet officers. We got into music videos. We did Rooster for Alice in Chains. We did When September Comes for Green Day. We got into video games, and we advised on the entire series of the Medal of Honor series for Electronic Arts. And then I started a publishing company called Warriors Publishing Group that published not only my books. I think I've got about 12 novels published now, but other authors, other military veterans who were authors and wanted their stories to be told and were good enough to produce a novel. We do that sort of thing. So without really meaning to, and believe me, I didn't mean to, we've sort of become a mainstay in Hollywood. And once again, that's more information than you wanted, but there it is.
Well, we are talking to one of a person who I consider a mainstay in Hollywood. He is retired Marine Corps Captain Dale Dye, who you may remember from such small films as Platoon, Saving Private Ryan, JFK, another one that you did along with Oliver Stone, and being involved in particular, one of my favorite things that's ever been put on film, Band of Brothers, where you played Colonel Sink, and were also a military advisor. I remember getting it on DVD and seeing the behind the scenes, and they did a feature on the boot camp, essentially, that you put all the actors from Band of Brothers through, and they spoke about you in reverential tones. So I wanted to ask you about your experience with the Hollywood actors and the fact that there's also just not a lot of veterans out there in Hollywood. We do have some. One of your fellow Marines, of course, is Adam Driver, who plays Kylo Ren in the new Star Wars series. He was a Marine. R. Lee Ermey is still doing his thing out there. But would you like to see more veterans out there in Hollywood, not only behind the camera, but in front of it as well?
Yeah, absolutely I would, Eric. You know, I think, listen, the current veteran talent pool is really deep. But it's underutilized. I can't tell you how many hundreds of phone calls, emails, letters I get regularly, every month, from young men and women who are just out of the service, and they want to be at, not some of them want to be the next Captain Die, and I get that, and that's fine. But they want to be actors or writers or film technicians of some sort, and they have no idea how to get involved. And frankly, there is no good answer that I can give them, because the film community, the motion picture community, and there's only two big clumps of it, one big clump in New York and one big clump in L.A., and it's really a tight-run ship. Mm. It's often a closed shop. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It has to do with hubris. It has to do with the fact that there is a pot full of money involved.
Right.
And the more people you allow to suck out of that pot full of money, the less money there is for you. And it's, you know, there's a lot of underappreciation for young men and women who want to get into this business. And frankly, those who try are sometimes very often exploited.
Right.
So that they can't make a living and they can't break into this, and it causes enormous frustration. And that frustration often leads to misbehavior.
Right.
To bad patterns of lifestyle. And so I'm enormously disappointed in that. And I'm, you know, every chance I get, like this one, I climb up on a soapbox and piss and moan about it. And I urge, you know, it's one thing to say thank you for your service, and we appreciate it, and we love you guys and gals and so on and so forth. That's all fine.
Right.
But that's chin music. That's lip service.
Yeah. It absolutely
is. If you really appreciate what these men and women have done for you, for our nation, for the freedoms that they've helped buy for you, for the security that they've helped buy for you, then give them a shot.
Yep. And we're speaking with a man who was given that shot way back in the 80s when he started a career in film that includes behind-the-scenes work, training people in front of the camera work, playing various characters in everything from Platoon to Natural Born Killers, Starship Troopers, Band of Brothers, retired Marine Corps Captain Dale Dye. And Dale, we're running out of time here. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to make sure I touched on something. You're speaking of Hollywood, and there is a new way of doing things, and that is crowdfunding. And I understand that you're actually working on crowdfunding a project right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, Eric, and thanks for the opportunity. It's a film that I've written, and as I said, I've learned to be a filmmaker at the elbow of the absolute best, and they've been kind enough to teach me the state of the art. And so I wrote a film called No Better Place to Die. It's a World War II feature in which talks about the seizure and defense of a bridge and a causeway in Normandy,
right,
that literally saved D-Day. Had that bridge not been taken, the Germans would have blown right through and possibly pushed all of our landing forces right off of Omaha and Utah Beach. And so this little band of paratroopers misdropped all over the peninsula, got together, took a bridge at Lafayette and that the long causeway that went on the other end of the bridge, and they defended it. And that's a wonderful story. That's a microcosm of all the heroic things that went on in World War II. When the big plans swirl down into the crapper, the little guys, the sergeants, the lieutenants, the PFCs, they get together and they know the commander's intent and they get it done. So I want to tell that story. And I want to direct it because I wrote it and because I understand it.
Right.
But Hollywood objects to that because, you know, I'm not a known auteur.
Yeah.
And so I decided, you know, the hell with it. I'll do it myself. And so we began on Indiegogo to ask fans and veterans and people who understand what we're doing to give us a hand. On a film called No Better Place to Die.
And where can people go to find out about that if they're interested in finding out more information or maybe even donating to it?
Right there on Facebook. Look up No Better Place to Die. That'll take you directly to the Indiegogo site. And thanks for the opportunity to pump that.
And that was, of course, our interview with Dale Dye, previously recorded. Dale from such great projects as Band of Brothers. Actually, that's my favorite one that he was in, playing Colonel Sink. He was fantastic in that. He's been fantastic in a lot of other things as well, including, as we mentioned there, Platoon and so many others. Really fascinating guy. Speaking of fascinating guys, Justin Brown from Hill Vets, he's in the house, and he'll be with us in just a few moments, talking about everything taking place on Capitol Hill that affects us in the veteran community. It's the Morning Briefing, back after this.
Helping military veterans stay connected.
We make it easy.
We are CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting vets every day.
Online and all over social media. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter at Connecting Vets.
Welcome back to the Morning Briefing for Tuesday, October 10th, 2017, 10-10-17. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer, and ConnectingVets.com is your website. And we mean that. We are veterans ourselves, or tightly tied to the veteran community. How tightly? How about the spouses of veterans, the children of veterans? Everybody at the ConnectingVets.com team is very close to or an actual member of the veteran community. I did 13 years in the Navy. Jake did 13 years in the Army. And our next guest who joins us is in studio now as we await a phone call that'll hopefully be coming momentarily, or I will be very irritated if it doesn't. Jonathan Kopanger, also a Navy veteran. That's
9 years.
I know he's good people. 9 years. What year did you join?
87.
87 to
86 or 87, one of those. I don't remember.
Something like that. That's a good long time, though. Now, while you were in, did you ever get in trouble while you were in the Navy, Jonathan?
I'm one of those people who have worked their entire life to not get in trouble. Mm. I'll be sneaky about things, but for the most part, no, I don't get in trouble. So to answer your question, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. All right. So that's a good thing. If you had been on board the USS Shiloh and you got in trouble for something minor, let's say you were late one day, which, you know, if the ship leaves port, that's a big deal. If the ship is in port and you're like 20 minutes, half hour late, it's a big deal. It's not the end of the world. You'll probably end up going to usually getting dealt with at the divisional level. There'll be a chief or a senior chief or a master chief who hands it to you, essentially. Well, apparently on board the USS Shiloh, morale took a tumble in part because the captain, Navy Captain Adam Aycock, who is now up at the Naval War College, when he was on this ship, which was forward deployed to Yokosuka, Japan. Mm-hmm. If you ever see something that looks like Yokosuka, Japan, it's Yokosuka. That's how it's pronounced. There's your Navy tip of the day. Apparently, for very minor things, from what these reports are saying and from what the sailors on the ship say, he was sentencing people to 3 days in the brig, that's jail for you non-sailors and Marines, with bread and water as their only nourishment.
Now, okay, when you first told me about this morning, there was part of me that said, okay, I like bread, I like water.
For 3 days.
I could lose a little bit of weight.
Yeah.
But I'm not thinking I'm going to get like good flat bread with a little bit of sea salt on top there in the brig. So really for just like small infractions,
small things, it looks like there are, you know, there were some examples, one of them, and it's not in context, so it's hard to know, but here's what Military Times has, and that's who's reporting this story, our friends over there. One sailor got bread and water in part for lying about his mother living, quote, in a dangerous area, according to records. What does that mean?
Well, and how did they find out?
Yeah. I
mean, and what's dangerous to somebody isn't necessarily dangerous to me. So
yeah. And what does that have to do with anything? My guess is, as someone who made it to Petty Officer First Class, where I occasionally would have to be at Captain's Mast, that's essentially an Article 15 hearing on a ship where the captain of the ship of a Navy ship has all sorts of powers that commanding officers in other places just don't.
Right.
I mean, they are essentially their god on board the ship. They are judge, jury, executioner. Well, not necessarily executioner. They probably have someone do that for them if there was, like, you know, can you
off
imagine
his head.
The captain just came out there with like a sidearm, just like, all right, so if you're guilty today, oh, by the way, I'm the one who decides if you're guilty. So Essentially, this sounds to me, the one about the mother living in a dangerous area, like someone who was trying to explain their shortcomings by saying they were having family problems, maybe worried about their mother living in a dangerous area. Then they did the research and they were like, your mother lives in a mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut. How dangerous could that be? Something like that. But at least six other sailors, so we're talking about seven, eight sailors in total, would receive bread and water in a two-year period. So we're talking about seven people over 2 years under this captain for offenses including curfew violations and underage drinking.
I don't remember ever hearing of anyone getting bread and water.
Never. And they talked to, Military Times talked to a retired captain who says, listen, I did it once in my entire career, and it was at the behest of the chief's mess, who the other choice was separating the sailor, kicking the sailor out who was troubled. They said, you know what? I think we can get through to him if we do this. I think he just needs to know that there are, you know, repercussions, but they thought this this sailor was salvageable. So they, you know, he did it once. This guy did it seven times in a two-year period. I didn't even know it was still a thing, but apparently this rule is still on the books. And here's the good thing, Jonathan. I came into the Navy because I was a U.S. Naval Sea Cadet before I came in. I came in as an E3. And then I guess about a year and a half or so after I joined, I was promoted to E4. I took the test and became a petty officer third class. As soon as I put on that crow, I would not have been eligible. Bread and water is for E3 and below only.
Really?
Yeah. It's restricted to your junior sailors. So it would seem to be the kind of thing where they're like, oh, this is just to, handle things and maybe put a little scare into them, you know, like that Beyond Scared Straight program they have on A&E or whatever.
Okay. I could see where it could be used, but I mean, I'm speechless with it because are there any guidelines that go with this? Are there certain rules that the captain would have to follow? Or can he just say, do it?
No, captain can just say, do it. I mean, essentially, that's what happens on any ship. I've told the story, I think off the air, about the commanding officer of the first ship I was on, which was the USS Saipan. One of my jobs working in the public affairs office was running Sight TV, which is the onboard television system for a ship. I played a movie that was approved by the Naval Motion Picture Service, which includes like admirals look at him and go, like, okay, this is acceptable, called Original Sin, starring Antonio Banderas and Angelina Jolie. And it had a little bit of that nudity and a little bit of the sexuality in it. When I say a little bit, I mean a significant amount. It wasn't like a Skinamax movie, but it was getting close to it. The captain of the ship came storming in and was like, you will pull that movie out and you will never play it again. And I said, no, I won't. Because we had written directives from the admiralty saying, like, no one, not even the captain of the ship, is to decide once these are good to go, we're putting them on there unless there are extenuating circumstances. And someone saying, like, I don't think we should be seeing naked people, that didn't fall under what they said for extenuating circumstances. So I had the captain of a large deck amphibious assault ship saying to a petty officer, I think second class at the time, Dame, are you seriously telling the captain of the ship? And I was like, yeah. And then she got very upset. She walked out. And then one of my division chiefs, not the chief who worked in my office, because I wouldn't have listened to anything he said anyway. It's a very interesting relationship. That chief is in prison for the rest of his life. One of the other chiefs that I did respect from my division came in and said, hey, I understand that you're going by the guidelines. If this stops here, you're not going to get in any kind of trouble. But if you continue on making this stand, this might be an issue. And I was like, all right, I'll listen to you. So, captains essentially on ships are, again, judge, jury, executioner, anything that they say, it is what it is.
But nothing can happen to this guy now.
No, he's at another command. Now, this comes along with other stories. There are like three stories on the Shiloh that have come out showing that there were concerns for their sailors among their readiness and safety as they were getting ready to, go out to sea. And maybe they're out and forward deployed to Yokosuka, so they may be dealing with the North Korea situation. One of the quotes there, Military Times, saying, boy, I hope we don't have to shoot down a North Korea missile because I don't know if this ship is actually capable of it.
Really?
One quote from the sailors there, paraphrasing here because I've lost my place and I had it before, but essentially saying it seems like a race to see which will break down first, the ship or the crew, under this captain.
But that was the old captain. They have a different captain now.
This was under a Captain Acock. percent of respondents. So there's also a survey that was done with the sailors where under the previous captain, who was named Morris, 63% trusted that the organization's leadership will treat them fairly. 63% is not that high, but on a Navy ship, listen, there are people who just hate being on ships. Yeah. There are people who always feel like the command's out to get them. So that's actually probably a little bit, maybe a little below average, but mm-hmm. fairly close to the average, I would say, Navy-wide. Under this other captain, Acock, 31% trusted the organization's leadership would treat them fairly. Only 37% felt motivated to give their best efforts, as opposed to 70% under the old captain. 68% proud to tell others they belong to this organization, being the ship, only 35% under the new captain, including one sailor saying he wouldn't even wear his command ball cap, which is one of those things in the Navy. You know, if you're on a ship, you get the ball cap and it has a special design and how people know where you're from. Almost got me in trouble once. I went to a Best Buy in the Norfolk, Virginia area mm-hmm. in a uniform that you're not supposed to go to Best Buy in my utilities. And a chief saw me and came over. It was to buy a Christmas gift. I was going on leave. I wasn't going to have any time when I got there. So I was buying, a Christmas gift for my stepsister. And the chief was like, "What command are you from?" And I was like, "I don't know." trying to cover up my name tape so he couldn't look me up because my name was kind of unique. This chief was smart. She was trying to get behind me to be able to see the ball cap that I had tucked into the back so she would know what ship it was. I was able to keep that hidden and got away with it. never heard anything about it. But ball caps are an identifier of what command you're from. Apparently, some of the sailors on the Shiloh in Yokosuka would not wear their ball caps even to go to the exchange. You have mm-hmm. the option of wearing like the general Navy ball cap that you get at boot camp, essentially. And there were people who refused to wear the Shiloh ball cap because they didn't want people knowing what command they were from. Because according to this, according to the statements filed during this survey, mm-hmm. some of them said even the taxi drivers in the Yokosuka and Tokyo area around the base knew that they were from the quote USS Bread and Water. Yeah. Now, Naval Surface Force Commander John Perkins tells Military Times that to date, confinement on bread and water remains a valid punishment. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. I remember people threatening it, but I never once in 13 years. Now, to be fair, I only spent 3 out of those 13 years on board ships. I never once saw it actually put into place. And considering my two ships had significant issues while I was there, you would have thought that you would see it there. I mean, my first ship, we had guys murdered. We had a guy overdose on board. We had a guy in my shop die because he made the right decision of drinking and then not getting behind the wheel. He made the wrong decision of getting into a vehicle with another sailor mm-hmm. who had been drinking, who was behind the wheel. They crashed their car, and that young petty officer who worked for me was killed in that accident. We were in the shipyard. We had a shipyard worker fall off the flight deck down into the dry dock and be severely injured. I think died eventually from the injuries. I mean, and a lot of other just significant issues that were going on around that time. Never saw anybody put in the brig with bread and water. Never saw it on my second ship, the Frank Cable, forward deployed to Guam, which again, that command, you know, if there were ever a command that was going to do that, I guess the captain was all right. And that would have been the person deciding it, but never heard of this before. And this guy did it 6 times in 2 years. Whereas other people are like, I did it once in a 30-plus-year career, six, seven times in 2 years. It seems a bit much.
I mean, at least he didn't like tie him to the, I'm trying to do some Navy terms and I can't, tie him to the yardarm and flog him. I don't know. Is that anything?
Yeah, we don't keel haul anymore.
So at least there wasn't that. But my question is, and this was the Shiloh, right?
Yeah.
Now you said that they were waiting for the ship to break down. What was going to break down first, the ship or the crew? Has things improved?
It doesn't say, because it takes a while for this information to come out, these surveys. And this is, you know, this is a guy who is no longer there. But this ship is part of the same destroyer group out there that included the Fitzgerald and the McCain, which are both involved in crashes that killed 17 sailors. So it just seems, you know, kind of tied to it, I guess, essentially. So he was on the Shiloh from June 2015 until August Before that, he was a commander of a destroyer at a float training group, Mayport, down in Florida. The Mayhan, which is a destroyer, and then also at a float training group, Mayport, in Jacksonville. So a lot of people, Navy Times, which is, of course, the Military Times Navy newspaper that they have, maybe it's now just a website, I don't know. I don't shop at the Exchange anymore, so I don't see Navy Times that often. Three retired Navy surface warfare skippers reviewed the surveys for Navy Times and expressed dismay, and it questioned if the Navy did enough to correct the situation. It seems they didn't.
Yeah.
And this guy has now moved on, and he's now some sort of researcher, it says, at the Naval War College, which is up in Newport, Rhode Island. So you wonder, I mean, could this have an adverse effect on any designs he has on a continuing career? Because if you've been a captain for a while, there's essentially what amount to term limits on each rank. So if he doesn't put on a star, become an admiral, there's going to be a time where he has to get out, essentially. I think his captains are like 30, 35 years, something like that. It's very interesting to think that this was such a repeated punishment. And what were the other officers on the ship thinking about this? What were the chiefs and senior chiefs and master chiefs thinking about this?
Well, that's why I need to know more information. But I was thinking about, there's this reality program that I watch that it's my husband makes fun of me. It's called Below Deck. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
It's about the kids who work on the yachts.
Yeah. So this season, it's a very green crew.
Right.
And they're constantly, you know, just like whining about having to work and having to do this. And they brought this new bosun's mate on who is actually making them work. And they're whining about it. And I keep thinking, when I watch, I just keep thinking back. And I was not stationed on a ship, but I've been on many. You listen to what the captain says. The captain is the one that really kind of makes sure that you stay alive.
Yeah.
And everybody has to work together. Everybody has to do what they're supposed to do in order to keep the ship afloat. Yeah. And I'm watching this, you know, Below Deck, and it's like, you people have no clue what this is like. And you're on a really nice yacht.
Yeah.
You know.
They're beautiful yachts, and they have a few different versions of that show. And I remember on the first, I think the second season of it, and I think it was on the first too, there was a Marine Corps veteran who was working on the ship, the big rip dude, you know, as many Marines are. When it comes to a Navy ship, how I've found, and how I think most sailors would agree works best, is that there is a command structure on a Navy ship, as there are most military units, with a top three, which is the commanding officer, the captain, the executive officer, who is the number one, essentially, for all you Star Trek fans out there, Commander Riker. He would be the XO of the Enterprise. And then, something that you don't have on Star Trek, the Command Master Chief.
Right.
So, what I've always found worked best, and what I think most sailors would agree with, is captain is the nice guy. Captain's the guy who keeps morale up, makes the good decisions. The XO is essentially
the hammer,
a tool, a delivery method for the CO. He doesn't want to deliver the bad news. That's an XO's job. And by proving that you're capable of doing that job on behalf of the CO, kind of proves that you're able to take responsibility for things, even things that might not be yours, put you into that leadership spot. So the XO is kind of the bad guy, you know, good cop, bad cop.
CO's have we heard good from cop. The XO on this?
XO's bad cop. And then you, no, we haven't heard anything that I've heard on there. And then the Command Master Chief, who of course is your senior enlisted leader, who is a bit of an intermediary. And I found two different types of Command Master Chief. And I think this goes with the senior enlisted. They were the type who felt that it was their job to be the intermediary between the command and the enlisted segment of the crew, and to protect the enlisted segment as much as they could. Because once you're a Command Master Chief, you ain't going anywhere else.
And there's really nothing that people can do to you.
No, there is literally. I mean, they can fire you, and we've seen that happen with like a couple chiefs of boats on submarines and things like that. There's no place to go. Mm-hmm. You're not getting promoted anymore unless you're one of these guys that wants to be Master Chief, Petty Officer of the Navy, or a Fleet Master Chief, which is essentially just being selected for a job. There's no place to go. Mm-hmm. You can't be reduced in rank unless you commit some sort of very serious crime.
Yeah.
It's not an issue. However, you have some of those Command Master Chiefs, and I served under some of them at various places overseas in stateside. Those who seem to be, I don't know what the word I'm looking for here is, but I almost want to say sociopaths, but I don't think that's the right one, where they think that it's their job to basically, be an extension of the XO as that hammer, and to kind of make life miserable for everybody else and be the enforcer of the rules, which a good CMC, I think, makes sure everybody is aware of the rules and then relies on his senior chiefs and chiefs to enforce those rules. The greatest Command Master Chief I ever worked with was a guy named James Griffin, who was a prior CB. Mm-hmm. When you become a Command Master Chief, your job in the Navy, your previous rate, becomes meaningless. Yeah. You are a Command Master Chief. Yeah. It's what you do. He was fantastic. Again, he did that. He worked, this was at a recruiting district, worked to keep morale high,
yeah,
made sure everybody was getting a fair shake, made mm-hmm. sure that if someone was going to non-judicial punishment, that there was a good reason for it. I had a senior chief who had ulterior motives down there. I was the only non-khaki, non-chief who was a department head.
Yeah.
This senior chief who headed up a different department thought, well, if I can bring that department under me, that looks better on my eval. I think he thought it would get him promoted to Master Chief because mm-hmm. he was coming up on high year tenure. So what he essentially tried to do is get me sent to Captain's Mast. He tried to make something up to get me an Article 15, a non-judicial punishment, where yeah. I might be reduced to E5, or at the very least would be removed from department head status and put into, you know, folded into his yeah. department. Luckily, the Command Master Chief sniffed out what was going on pretty easily, where I had a meeting to go to, and then after that meeting, it would have taken me 45 minutes to get back to my base, and there was only 30 minutes left in the workday, so mm-hmm. instead, I went home, which yeah. was closer to the meeting. That guy said that, you know, dereliction of duty, should have come back to the, I'm like, nobody was here. What was I coming yeah. back to? I would have come back for, you know, 15 minutes of work or something like that. So, you know, and the Command Master Chief. So it went to DRB, Disciplinary Review Board, where you sit there with a bunch of chiefs and the Command Master Chief threw it out. So that's kind of one of those things that a Command Master Chief is for. But on a ship, it's so unique to military life. And as yeah. you said, you've been on them. You haven't been stationed on any during your 9 years in, but it is... To me, it was a depressing place to be. Ships were not fun. I happened to be on two ships that I asked people who had spent most of their careers on ships who were on board with me, is this normal or have I just had bad luck? And they said, no, you've had bad luck. The second one was essentially a ship run by submariners, you know, people from submarines, because it was a sub tender. So they're weird little way of doing things. There, I think we may be getting our phone call now with 4 minutes left. Oh boy. So their little weird way of doing things on a surface ship. But this thing taking place on the Shiloh is something totally different. Never heard of it. It happened once, and it happened several times on board the Shiloh. So we are looking at a very interesting scenario where you wonder, can anything, especially with the press this is getting, Navy Times, mm-hmm. Military Times, putting this out there, could something happen to this guy retroactively? I kind of doubt it. What's more interesting is that this seems to be almost more indicative of an inability to correct things by this command over there, who had these two ships that were involved in crashes that ended up in loss of life. These reports, the Navy was aware of them. His commanders, his bosses, because even when you're a captain of a ship, you got bosses.
Yeah.
Their bosses were aware of it, said they were counseling him on it, didn't remove him from command.
Oh, so the captain was counseled.
Oh, yeah. According to the story, yeah. They say that, you know, there were basically admirals and folk, other captains who were higher than him on the chain of command.
Uh-huh.
That they knew about it and that they were. So here's what we have. Retired captain by the name of Lovely told Navy Times, shocked to hear that leadership was tracking this nightmare and willing to be patient for a major commander to learn how to lead and respect. It's easy for me to say, but if this was one of my 05 COs when I was Commodore, the relief process would have been quickly undertaken. But then you have another retired captain who said there are very few signs that the surveys were briefed to the bosses. I mean, this story, and of course, it's at Navy Times. It's not a story that we have right now. So, we oftentimes, though, when we find something like this, you got to talk about it because it's something that all of our Navy and Marine Corps veterans out there, and really everybody in the military, I mean, bread and water. I thought that was from back in like the days when we were fighting the Barbary pirates and things like that.
One side of me is a little shocked by this, but the other side, having been on a boat and knowing that your life depends on everybody working together, was there a reason for it?
Yeah.
And could it have been just, as you kind of said earlier, just a overall issue of what was going on with that group.
Yeah. And again, with the other two ships, the McCain and the Fitzgerald, this seems to be more indicative of the chain of command there above the ships, at the group level in the Navy, were just not doing what they should have been.
And some of those people have been removed.
Oh, yeah. They have. Yeah. There have been quite a few already that have been fired over there. We've seen some admirals fired, their careers ended essentially, given the opportunity to retire. You know, they're not facing charges or anything, although when you talk about loss of life and you start seeing a pattern of not paying attention to everything mm-hmm. that's going on, you could certainly see how there could be some charges filed, but they're not going to do that to flag officers yeah. typically, unless they're dealing with Fat Leonard, which is a whole different deal over there, which we're not going to go into
but
today.
If something were to happen with North Korea, these would be the ships yeah. that we would need to rely on, correct?
Yeah, our forward deployed ships in Japan.
Somebody needs to get their act together.
That's 7th Fleet. That's Pacific yeah. Theater, and they are the closest to. I mean, look at a map. Look at where Japan and Korea are. Yeah. They're right there. I mean, yeah, you've got Pearl Harbor, but Pearl Harbor is a few days away, yeah, even if you're steaming full speed, even for our carriers, which mm-hmm. are the fastest of our vessels. As far as the small boys that are out there, the destroyers, the frigates, those are all going to be coming from Yokosuka, and those are going to be the ones that have the ability to get there, unless they're already on deployment yeah. on patrol over there. But again, if these sailors are worried about the amount of preparation and training that they've been able to do, mm-hmm. and they're saying, boy, hope we don't have to shoot down a missile.
Yep.
Coming out of North Korea, that's not a good sign. And when you couple in the fact that 17 lives were lost, you know, a lot of the Navy veteran community is up in arms over this and saying, hey, what was going on? What yeah. happened here? Where was the leadership? Yeah. Because that's who this falls on. Now, this story of bread and water, that's specifically a leadership issue, but a lot of other leadership issues implied. I imply that it's been a lovely Tuesday here, even though I am under the weather. Thank you to Jonathan. Thank you to Justin from Hill Vets and the rest of our guests today. Dale Dye, Captain Dale Dye. You can look him up on social media and check out his new movie, Morning Briefing. See you tomorrow.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.